Okay, I'm going to go ahead and start. And to make this, to make the transition back to the, my presentation most simple, I'm going to start out by doing sort of a very brief tutorial on First Amendment law and what everyone ought to know about it. To begin with, my name is Li Tian. I'm a senior staff attorney for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We are a San Francisco-based internet civil liberties group. We've been around since mid-1990. We do free speech, privacy, computer crime, intellectual property stuff that affects civil liberties on the internet. We're not a traditional civil liberties organization. We don't deal with a lot of the issues that groups like the ACL do in terms of, say, racial discrimination, religious discrimination, more of the classic civil rights type stuff. What we do, what we really focus on are things like First Amendment rights, Fourth Amendment rights, consumer privacy, et cetera, but also with a real strong focus on culture. If any of you were at my talk yesterday about internet fair use, then you know that one of the things that we're trying to do is to look forward from where we are today in terms of how much of our culture, the things that people write, the music people make, the art that people create, is being owned and owned by large corporate interests in a way that it'll be locked up for a very long time and won't be available to us to be used in creating more later works. We have a staff of about 18. Five of us are attorneys. The rest are clerical and support. As you can see, I use a Mac. Most of the other people in the office use either Windows or Linux or some. We're very cross-platform. One of the things that we used to do a lot of, we still do, but it's not as lucrative anymore, is we used to be very focused on open source issues. We still care a great deal about open source and appear at all the open source conventions, but because open source companies like Red Hat and VA Linux don't have as much money as they used to, we're not getting quite the same level of support. Now, I think everybody is generally familiar with the First Amendment. For our purposes, it says, you know, Congress shall make no law, ... abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. A few quick points. The press clause today means very little. Virtually, even 50 years ago, the press clause lost pretty much any of its independent significance because there is relatively little that the press does that isn't already included within the notion of speech. Probably the only area in which the press still has some sort of institutional standing, apart from any ordinary citizen, is in the area of access to limited environments. You know, the White House press corps, getting into prisons, getting into courtrooms. You know, obviously the press is going to have some sort of special role there because there's only so many spots. And we find both locally, and it may be the case here, people who are online journalists have a harder time getting press credentials than people in the traditional print media. So, you know, people who do that sort of thing in our area, they often need lawyers like us to come out and, like, write letters to the police department or whatever, saying, please issue these folks press credentials or we will sue you. So that's, you know, sort of the basic starting point. Now, what does the freedom of speech actually protect? People often think of freedom of speech as protecting things, books, movies, speeches, whatever. That's a useful shorthand because it's easy to say, "Why? Wow, this book is protected speech," or "this book isn't." It is more precise, however, to think in terms of speech acts and not speech. What is really protected is a particular act with, done with respect to a book. Selling a book, reading a book, writing a book. Hitting a person on the head with a book is not protected speech, even though you are using a book. And that sounds like a stupid, trivial point, but a lot of people... But the reason why I emphasize it is because it's sloppy thinking to just sort of assume that because something is protected by the First Amendment, then anything you do with it is. And this especially gets us into trouble with internet stuff because there are a lot of issues, especially with respect to software and source code, where the sort of distinction between speech as a thing and speech as an act becomes, really interesting. Now, with that in mind, let's think about the different types of speech. And I think at this point I will actually be able to get to my presentation. Whoops. Wrong click. Et voila. Okay, and oh yes, I had forgotten that I had subtitled this Beyond Sex and Violence because there are a lot of interesting themes now that go beyond these traditional areas of government censorship. Beyond sex and violence, that means technological speech. That means private or public information that's affected with sort of a private interest. There are a number of cases going on right now where people, journalists or would-be journalists, are publishing people's social security numbers, people's addresses. Often this is going to, and this cuts along both many sides of the political spectrum. Sometimes they're doing this to try to harass people in terms of, abortion doctors. Other people, they're trying to expose police corruption. And so they're saying, hey, this guy's a corrupt cop, and here's where he lives, and let's make him feel the pressure. More than government censorship. Well, that's the issue of how private companies are using various laws to chill speech. One nice example is not even a company, is the Church of Scientology. This is a group that does a great deal all over the internet, and they've done so for years. They're doing it just as much now. And they use the copyright laws, they use trade secret laws to claim that the works that they produce within their church are actually proprietary. And so just this year, they threatened Google with a lawsuit under the IP laws because Google was linking to someone's page that contained what they alleged to be these proprietary documents. And Google actually took down... made it impossible for anyone to reach those pages, searching on Google. I mean, this is the sort of private censorship that we should all be very, very concerned about because, search engines, that sort of thing, are what actually keeps us able to keep track of what's going on the internet. And then the third point is that it's not just censorship coming out of the U.S. or U.S. laws. There are a lot, because the internet is global, there is tremendous international dimension to censorship today. And again, sometimes it's private groups outside the United States. Other times it's foreign governments. There are concerns in many countries about hate speech that comes out of the United States. The United States is viewed by the rest of the world as a free speech haven. And the funny thing is they don't mean that in a nice way. They mean that in the sense that we are coddling people who are speaking freely the same way that someone else might say, oh, they're a drug lord haven. I mean, that's the way the rest of the world tends to view the First Amendment. And so, for instance, an example of that is when Yahoo was sued by a private group in France under French anti-Semitism laws. Among the things that these French laws do is they prohibit any trafficking in Nazi ideas and Nazi memorabilia. And people were using Yahoo and auctioning off some coins and weapons and this sort of thing that were Nazi, and and Yahoo was sued and lost in French court. And then this took another turn in the United States, which I'll talk about later. So these are the old traditional themes that we're familiar with in First Amendment law. Sex. I will be talking a lot about that. Today it is more about protecting the children than it is about protecting the morals of adults. The private censorship, for a very long time, the First Amendment was thought to only apply to government action. And there is generally in the area of constitutional law this notion of a state action doctrine. It's one thing if the government tells you to shut up. It's another thing if your employer does. But in a couple of areas, there is a general principle that if you're using state law in the service of certain kinds of censorship, then the First Amendment still has application. And libel, defamation, is one of those areas. Now, there actually hasn't been that much interesting going on in defamation law as applied to the Internet because in 1996, Congress passed a law, 47 U.S.C. Section 230, which actually provides immunity to Internet service providers for libel that is contained on their website if it's posted by someone else. So, for instance, if AOL has a chat room, and you and I, as a chat room user, go ahead and say scurrilous, legally actionable things about someone else, I can be sued, but AOL can't be. This is a departure from the traditional rules of libel and defamation, where a secondary publisher or a republisher was still going to be liable for defamation. Congress decided that this would make it impossible for the Yahoos or AOLs or any other kind of forum to really operate effectively on the Internet, and so they created this immunity. The one interesting thing and good thing that has happened is this immunity, in our opinion, has spread. So now, even if you're not an ISP, say you're just a website, maybe you are collecting complaints and reviews or whatever of restaurants or landlords or whatever, so long as you're not the person that provides the content, that the statement, maybe you have people who write in the blog or on a bulletin in post in there and say, oh, well, my landlord really sucks and he's done this, that, and the other thing to me, and 17 other people in the 29 slumlord apartment buildings he owns. If you're the host of the website and you're not the one who actually originates that content, you receive the protections of the CDA Section 230, which makes it possible for a lot of people to have sort of open forums. Censorware is the other area of private censorship that continues to be important since the mid-1990s. That means programs like SmartFilter, XStop, NetNanny, iGear, et cetera, that are designed to block people's access to websites. These have been big in schools, big in libraries. They are growing in, they're very big in corporations and other kinds of institutions. Then, the rest of the world. This is the First Amendment safe harbor haven problem that I was talking about. One of the sort of funny things, which I won't have time to go into now, is that, we're also exporting censorship very, very effectively because many American companies are the ones that provide the censorware that companies like China, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, et cetera, actually use to prevent their populations from seeing things that they don't want to see. And So it's one of the ironic or perhaps intended consequences of the American government's pushing of censorware is that it's going to make it easier for that kind of stuff to be done all around the world. And we're concerned about sort of the balkanization of the internet as more and more countries see, the internet may become the sort of elephant and all the different people in different countries or areas, like the blind man seeing only little parts of it and no one sees the whole. Well, what are the new themes? Well, the first, who's reading what where? This is something that's connected to all the sex stuff. It's connected to what we were talking about in terms of hate speech. It's connected to what we were talking about in terms of religion. Because there are so many different standards and different ideas of what speech is acceptable and not, there is a very, very big concern about, we have a big concern about how the internet is not going to be a medium that reaches everyone, because people will be blocked off by the companies they work for or the countries they live in. Techno speech, as I was about to get to when I was talking without my presentation, one of the big concepts in First Amendment law is that you cannot discriminate against speech or between speech on the basis of its content or meaning without an extremely strong justification. So, for instance, if you say, well, it's okay to talk about, to have speech supporting the Democrats but not supporting the Republicans, that's a form of content discrimination called viewpoint discrimination. Or you could say, well, you can talk about any subject except, and that's subject matter discrimination. And both of these are very strongly disfavored by the First Amendment. You have to pass what's called a strict scrutiny test in order to have that kind of a law stand up. I mean, some laws do survive that, but they're relatively few and far between. The technological speech, though, poses a really interesting issue here, and the question is basically if you can characterize the speech not less in terms of its meaning, but more in terms of its effects, like, well, gee, this would enable a hacker to break into something because this explains a security weakness. Well, is that something that we're going to treat as the content of the speech, or are we going to call it something that this is what the government likes and calls it, and Hollywood and the other industries have it adopted this. They call it functionality, and they're going to say, well, functionality isn't really the same as the content or meaning of the speech. And they got this idea when they were trying to control computer code, but the sort of idea has also spread out into how-to and instructions. So, this is a very critical area, especially for the internet. Anti-terrorism and surveillance. I think this is obvious. There's always been a connection between government surveillance in particular, but also private surveillance, and freedom of speech. If you believe you're being listened to, you're being watched, you are going to be less free most of the time in what you say. And certainly if you think you know who is watching you, you will be especially careful about saying anything about them. Ever since September 11th, this has become one of our big, big worries. Choke point. This is an attempt to try to articulate a problem we see with the architecture of the internet. There are a lot of places where speech is vulnerable because it's running through the system, but they're choke points. An ISP is an obvious place. If you don't have internet service, you're not going to have access to information. You're not going to be able to send email or whatever. So, many of the content industries are using this very effectively. Just a couple weeks ago, they went after a website that was based outside the United States, and they did so by suing a whole bunch of backbone providers like Verizon and whomever, and saying, well, it would be very easy for you to solve this problem for us. You can simply prevent anyone from accessing these sites. And fortunately, the foreign site went down before the case got any further than the complaint, but it was very clear that the recording industry would have kept going, and as a technical matter, that can be done. I mean, they can make it. They can make sites disappear if they want to. So, you know, I'll talk more about that. I already talked about this, except for the point about selling versus giving. A lot of people have. A lot of people aren't clear on this, but you know, just Barnes & Noble has just as much right. New York Times has just as much right to speak as someone who's giving it away for free. I mean, there's absolutely nothing in First Amendment law per se that says that selling speech is any less protected than giving it away. People are confused because there is this doctrine in First Amendment law called the commercial speech doctrine, and they think that selling stuff is commercial speech. In fact, commercial speech refers to speech that proposes an economic or commercial transaction. That is, it's mainly about advertising. This is where I was, sort of types of speech roughly ranked according to sort of a hierarchy, but, you know, not really. There is so-called unprotected speech, obscenity, child pornography. FW stands for fighting words. This is a very old category that really doesn't mean much anymore. It was, you know, back in the days of dueling and chivalry and this sort of thing. The courts actually accepted the notion there are certain words that, if uttered in someone else's presence to their face, were so likely as a social matter to provoke someone into responding that they were fighting words, and they were not protected by the First Amendment. It was like because the social convention at the time is that you had to defend your honor if someone called you a certain kind of name. That's really kind of gone away. Now, I have unprotected in scare quotes because, technically speaking, they're not really unprotected by the First Amendment. What they are is very, 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 very weakly protected. But the example that Justice Scalia used in one case was, well, you know, certainly the government has the power to regulate obscenity, but it could not say, it would still violate the First Amendment to say that all obscenity regarding Democrats was prohibited, but not all obscenity regarding Republicans. That would be a form of viewpoint discrimination that has no relationship to the reason why the category of obscenity is deemed unprotected speech. There has to be a sort of nexus between this, you know, sex reason for unprotecting obscenity and what you're actually doing. Low-value speech, indecency. This is comes out of the famous George Carlin 7 Dirty Words case, FCC versus Pacifica. There is this notion, strictly for the broadcast medium, TV and radio, that some speech cannot be, you cannot do that on the airwaves because young children, even those who can't read, can still hear, and then there's this notion of pervasiveness, that it enters the home unbidden. HTM, this does not have anything to do with hypertext markup language. HTM stands for harmful to minors. This is the more general concept that indecency is sort of a subset of. Harmful to minors basically means stuff about sex that we don't want kids to see. There is a somewhat more precise definition, which I'll present later. Advertising, commercial speech, I talked about that. Speech plus, symbolic speech, expressive conduct. These are all different ways, different sort of cuts at a big pie having to do with speech that isn't purely verbal. For a long, long time, the speech plus notion is no longer really used, but all of these things always come back depending on, you know, what a judge needs to do to get to where he wants to go. Picketing was considered, you know, back, this is, you know, 1920s, 1930s, labor unions came along and people were walking around with big signs. Clearly they were speaking. Clearly they were communicating. But at the same time, they were using their bodies to obstruct the sidewalks. They were making it more difficult for people to walk by. The courts had this real sense that this was not, should not be treated as ordinary speech. And so they coined this notion of speech plus. Symbolic speech, well, doesn't have the same sort of relation, but at the same time they're going, well, gee, you know, we don't know what that black armband says. It's just not as precise as verbal speech. So they created a category for that. Expressive conduct, flag burning, or draft card burning. Again, the idea was there was both speech and conduct tied up in the same course of action. How do we deal with it? In general, speech plus symbolic speech, expressive conduct, all these areas of speech are judged by a standard less exacting than that of strict scrutiny. It is easier for the government to regulate this kind of speech. And then we have the category of how-to speech, manuals that explain how to do things. There was a famous case just a couple years ago involving basically a hitman manual, how to be a hitman. And it's an extremely complex case that I can't even begin to describe. But let's just say that if you read that case and you can get past sort of the horrific and graphic aspects of it, you'll see that there are very serious implications for any kind of technical explanation of how to do something that could be used by someone else in a harmful way. And for engineering, for science, for medicine, biology, anything like that, we now have a real issue. It ties into the 911 thing because in January this year, the White House actually suggested to a major publisher, academic publisher that specialized in journals on microbiology and those sorts of areas that, you know, they really should be a hell of a lot more careful about the articles they publish that have to do with potential biological agents, because who knows, terrorists might be reading them and might be able to use them to, against the American interests. But, this would be the sort of thing that would cripple science because, scientific method requires that when you talk about this stuff, it's going to be, you're going to explain it clearly, you're going to enable people to do verifiable, replicable experiments, et cetera, et cetera. You know, there isn't any real between where you can talk about it in a general way without explaining how it's done and at the same time still be science. So this is going to continue to be a problem. Types of speech acts, we're all familiar with speech, but there's also the right to read, blah, 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 blah. Right to research comes up, especially in the context of hacking and reverse engineering. One last concept, tools of speech. Now, I said before, indecency goes with broadcasting TV. That shows how weak the protection is for that medium. Print has always been strong. The internet was declared in the Reno versus ACLU case involving the Communications Decency Act and its attempt to regulate indecent speech on the web. And they said there's no basis for qualifying the protection afforded to the internet because the internet is such a great medium of speech. Well, that sounded great, and it still sounds great. It's very good. But the developments since then have shown that it's not quite as true as one would like to think. And the main reason is that even though, as a formal matter, protection for speech on the internet is still legally high, it is very easy for the government to sort of artificially inflate, exaggerate, ramp up the claims that harm will be caused by disseminating speech on the internet. In virtually every case involving internet speech, you will see somewhere this theme that, well, if this were a print publication, it would only reach a few people. And that's what the old assumptions about the freedom of speech in the print medium are like. But, Your Honor, on the internet, there are so many more people who will read it, so much more possibility that harm will be caused. Yes, free speech on the internet should be free, but we can't ignore, all the harmful possibilities. And so coming in, it's an end run around this notion of harm, amplified by the fact that you're reaching millions and millions of people. Plus, There's also an appeal to, there's an elitist appeal, because, you know, as we all know, in the days where, you know, the print meant book publishers and newspaper publishers, freedom of speech belonged to those who owned a press, right? And, you know, how many people actually own a press or a, you know, print publishing house or whatever? There was almost a natural selection. You had to have real money. There was an elitism. The other thing that people commonly appeal to when they talk about internet speech, and they're trying to control it, is, well, you know, you can't really trust everybody. There are a lot of wackos out there. The internet is called the web of lies. There was an unstated assumption in our old First Amendment jurisprudence about print, was that we have more reason to trust, you know, the New York Times, you know, the Washington Post, Simon and Schuster, all those, you know, great rich people, but we can't trust Joe Sixpack or, you know, anybody out there just because they happen to be able to reach millions of people. So that's the other way people are really getting around this notion that the internet is as protected as print. The tools of speech idea also refers to regulations on things that you need in order to speak. So, you know, there are a few cases on this. We have worked with this argument for a while. You know, one of the main easier ways to think about why this is important is, first of all, the First Amendment has always protected the circulation and delivery of newspapers. And then to think about how, in the crypto context, we made the argument that, well, you know, cryptography was not only protected because the algorithms were scientific, that the paper our client wanted to publish was a piece of science, but also because the very use of cryptography was like putting an envelope around electronic mail or any other kind of document. And so our argument was, well, you know, if you banned envelopes and said that everybody had to talk, you had to write to each other using postcards, wouldn't that affect the content of the speech? Wouldn't people be less willing to say certain things and more willing to say others? How can you say that this kind of ban is neutral as to the meaning of speech? Okay. This is more issues, that legal issues that come up. You know, there's a very strong ban on prior restraints, but intellectual property law, copyright and trade secret, is an area that has never been considered to be affected by the First Amendment. Today it is, but in a very sort of grudging way. The courts are still struggling very hard to understand why they can't enjoin the publication of a book for copyright violations, just like they always used to. Precision, causation, and harm. I talked a lot already about this notion of harming the internet, so. And precision just means that the government has to try to tailor a regulation to the problem that it's dealing with. Okay, now let's get into some of the definitions. This is basically the legal definition of obscenity. I think all of you are intuitively familiar with it. The main point I wanted to make here is the italicized words, contemporary community standards. This is something that's making the regulation of internet obscenity very, very interesting. The correlate, harmful to minors. If you have a very good memory, you will realize that the thing I showed you just the previous slide is almost exactly the same as this. It uses the same three prongs. It's a little more specific here. This is taken from a statute, whereas the other one was taken from a constitutional case, Miller v. California, but the basic idea is still the same. It appeals to the prurient interest. It describes in a patently offensive way some sort of sexual act, and as a whole, it lacks serious value. Those are the three prongs, either for obscenity or harmful to minors. The only difference is that obscenity refers to adults, and this is saying, okay, well, what about kids? Yeah.
Is this an either or do all three of them have to apply?
All three.
I thought the Supreme Court overruled it.
No, I'm going to take the rest of the questions at the end. Thanks. But you know, remember it. Okay, now this is the trilogy of statutes and cases that currently involve internet sex. CDA, Communications Decency Act, COPPA, Children's Online Protection Act, and CHIPA, the Children's Internet Protection Act. Everyone is probably familiar with Reno versus ACLU. It only dealt with the CDA's indecency provisions. The CDA also has obscenity provisions. Those were not challenged in the CDA case in 1996-97. COPPA is the one that is up now before the Supreme Court. In fact, it just was decided this past term. This was Congress's attempt to improve on the CDA to cure some of the constitutional problems. They didn't really succeed. They substituted for indecency, which was the standard that applied to radio and TV, and for that reason it didn't work very well in the CDA case. They used harmful to minors, which was another old standard. Keep in mind, minors means 17 and under. EFF, ACLU, a bunch of civil liberties groups, are litigating this ACLU versus Ashcroft case. We won in the district court in Pennsylvania. We won in the Third Circuit in Pennsylvania. It got appealed to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court reversed, but fortunately they did not reverse the injunction. So the COPPA is still enjoined. It cannot be enforced. It's an interesting case because the two lower court decisions were very different. The district court decision, which we liked, focused almost completely on the fact that the statute was really imprecise, overbroad, a very traditional way of looking at it. The Third Circuit Court of Appeals said, well, that may be, but we prefer to decide it on a different grounds, and they decided on this ground, which opened up a huge can of worms, which is the idea that, well, gee, the harmful to minors, either it's going to be a national standard or a community-based standard, and if it's a community-based standard, how the hell are you going to apply it to the internet? If our clients, a gay and lesbian queer group is publishing stuff, and it's going into every state and every community, well, how are they supposed to know what standard is acceptable under harmful to minors? And in fact, isn't it the case that they're going to end up having to tailor their speech to that of the least tolerant community? So this is a big debate that will continue for a while, and it's going to be briefed more in another case I'll talk about. The CHIPA case is one that mandates the use of censorware in libraries and schools that receive certain federal funds. This was another attempt to deal with the problems that the CDA failed to deal with, but they didn't want to just say everybody has to use it. They said, well, if you receive this funding and that funding and whatever, then you have to put in these technical measures. We won the first round. This is in the district court in Pennsylvania. It is now being briefed in the Supreme Court. If you're familiar with censorware at all and the few cases that have dealt with it, you know censorware is extremely imprecise. It blocks lots of stuff that has nothing to do with sex pornography or whatever. And at the same time, it lets through a great deal of sex pornography that it's not supposed to. And one of the big problems, of course, is that all the keyword, all the kinds of techniques that censorware vendors use primarily are text-based. We still do not have a technology that can do any kind of image recognition. So as long as somebody doesn't use certain words, any kind of stuff can get through. So then the last thing I want to talk about on the sex area is the return of a CDA challenge. This is to the obscenity provisions. This is a case brought in New York. A little more on the geolocation issue. Normally, you pick either the place where something happens, as in, like, it was caused. Imagine I'm on one side of the border and you're on the other and I throw a rock and I hit you. So you can say, oh, well, the jurisdiction's where I threw it because I'm in state X, or the jurisdiction's in the other state because that's where the guy actually was harmed. And there are lots of rules about this sort of thing in the law. With respect to obscenity, because the government really doesn't like obscenity, the rules are such that any place that obscene matter travels, is the venue lies for a case. So this means that, you know, for the internet, you know, any place that's routed in theory, you know, could be the place where they go. And then, of course, since anyone can download it anywhere, then again, they have their choice of jurisdictions. They have a tendency to pick districts in Tennessee. This is a very, very popular area for obscenity prosecutions to be brought. And I suppose that's because the community standards in Tennessee are probably not the same as those in San Francisco. The Thomas case is one of those involving a BBS. This is actually a pretty old case, 1995 or 1996, a BBS in San Jose, California, not that far from where I live. But the postal inspectors were very interested in getting these people, in nailing these people, and there was somebody in, I think, the Eastern District of Tennessee that sort of, I would say, entrapped, but not really, probably, got them to mail something to Tennessee, and so they were convicted. Again, same issue as in COPPA. How do you do this? The reason why the COPPA decision is interesting, because even though it reversed that Third Circuit decision saying that harmful to minors and community standards weren't incompatible, six of the justices actually had a huge, huge problem with the logic. And there are several decisions in the case. No one is quite sure exactly how the question of community standards in the obscenity context will be handled. Keep in mind that this notion of geographical community standards was developed in 1973. It was developed in order to try to preserve some sort of diversity and localism in the speech marketplace. The justices in 73 saw that, well, it would be bad if the most conservative communities could decide what everyone sees. But they also thought it was bad if the most liberal communities could decide what everyone sees. And, you know, they didn't want New York to be decided by Tennessee or vice versa. So they came up with this community standards localism idea to try to sort of split the baby. And, you know, it was already creaking, but the internet pretty much really, really, really makes it very hard to maintain. Unless we try some interesting technical solutions. Unfortunately, the interesting technical solutions have bad implications of their own. One of them is a geolocation solution, which we're very concerned about. That is, there will be the argument that, well, if we force browsers and force websites and everybody to tag for IDs and locations, so that any web server will always know where the person is coming from, then the community standards can still be used because we'll know where you are and we won't serve New York content to a Tennessee person. That sort of idea, that we consider that to be really, really dangerous for the internet as well, for obvious reasons. Child porn, this is something that is a problem in a different way. One thing you have to remember about child porn is that it's not based on the same ideas as what we were just talking about, obscenity. Child porn is based on the notion that minors are harmed in the process of producing child pornography. If you want to go against something that's child porn on the basis that the content is bad or offensive, then you still have to meet the obscenity rules. But if you can show that a minor was used in the production of it, then it's much easier. What the you know, we don't have any problem with child porn law except for what the Congress keeps trying to do to it, which is to say things like, well, if someone just looks like a minor, you know, if you use an actor who is actually an adult but make them look like they're younger, then that should still be child porn. Or if you use a computer to create completely fictitious images of non-actual children and create this kind of child porn, that should also be prohibited as child porn. This case on virtual child porn went up to the Supreme Court, and it was decided this term. It's called Free Speech Coalition versus Ashcroft, and the Supreme Court made it very clear, you cannot legislate against virtual child porn that way. And all they did was repeat what I just told you, which is that if it isn't using an actual child, it isn't child porn. Go away. Congress doesn't like this. Congress is right now trying to rejigger the virtual child porn statute. And there are also stupid people who are, you know, trying to go against child modeling sites. You know, I don't have any sympathy for these sites. I mean, I think they are probably appealing to pedophiles and whatnot. But, you know, this is a way of doing it that really distorts the First Amendment, and we can't support that. But Congress typically does a lot of this kind of stuff more for showboating and trying to attract political support, and they don't really care about the constitutional implications. Threats. There is a recent case in the Ninth Circuit involving and called Planned Parenthood of Willamette County versus, I can't remember the guy's name, doesn't matter. It involved the so-called Nuremberg Files. This was an anti-abortion website that listed the names of lots and lots of abortion providers and had little headstones and whatnot and was viewed as a threat to the doctors. Because people thought that this was sort of an inducement or an incitement to go after and assassinate them, and these people were very definitely in fear of their lives. This is one of those hard cases, at least for some First Amendment people. I don't have a hard time saying that it's still protected speech. I mean, there was no proof that there was any kind of conspiracy or any kind of concerted action between the publisher and the website and anybody who might be inclined to do violence. It was very interesting because the website lost in the district court. Then it won in the Ninth Circuit. Then there was a rehearing in the Ninth Circuit en banc. The website lost 6-5. This is about as close as you can get. This is as close as you can get on a rehearing en banc. And I have to agree with the dissent. The big problem here was there was no real showing that this website owner intended and had any kind of joint plan that would lead to anybody being harmed. I also already mentioned the privacy versus public info issue. You know, there are cases where judges are saying, gee, you can't publish that social security number on your website, even though it's already in the public record and the government has, and you could get it from some other government paper site. The violence stuff is spreading out into other areas. We have a pair of cases involving violent video games. One in Indianapolis, it's gone up to the Eighth Circuit there, and it was found that an ordinance that regulated violent video games in arcades was unconstitutional. They were trying to say that, we already have harmful to minors for sex stuff. But isn't the violent stuff just as important? And you know, that's I have some sympathy with that argument. But it's you know, there's never been a case that said that violent speech is some per se less protected. And Judge Posner wrote a very nice opinion saying, look, you know, this is crazy. There is no law supporting you. Unfortunately, a really stupid judge in St. Louis got a similar case. And he said that, well, gee, video games aren't protected by the First Amendment. You know, there's no valuable expression there. And you know, if you read the opinion, you'll see that he is looking at some fairly bloody and gory games as his examples of what's not speech. So he's not even at the point where he's made a decision based on whether or not the speech was too violent. He's just saying, well, it's not even speech. I talked about these other points already, so I won't go over them. Okay, globalization. hate speech, the Yahoo case, the latest thing that's happened there is after Yahoo lost in France and the Yahoo France servers took down anything relating to Nazi memorabilia, there was remaining the issue of what about Yahoo US? Yahoo US is also accessible all over the world. Yahoo's business model, Yahoo has a sort of interesting business model. They have in-country or regional Yahoos as well as a Yahoo US. Now, the in-country regional Yahoos really do explicitly target and market their target the foreign market. So Yahoo France is in French, for instance, and clearly is directed at French citizens. Yahoo US, or the one that we're generally familiar with, is in English and doesn't make any sort of special effort to appeal to anyone other than a US persons. So the way Yahoo has tried to work it, and the reason why it chooses this business model, is because it wants to be able to say, okay, if a country's censorship laws or whatever is going to be applied to us, we will obey that law as for our local regional sites. But we are going to ignore it, or we would like to ignore it, as for our U.S. site, because we don't believe you have the right to tell us what to say coming out of the United States. Well, the French don't agree with that. Most countries don't agree with that. They would like very much to force the U.S. U.S. corporations to stop saying anything to them in their own countries they don't like, because they don't want their citizens to see it. That's what they care about. So Yahoo brought a declaratory judgment suit in the Northern District of California, suing the French group and saying that basically saying the judgment you won in France is not going to be valid in the United States, and we want a ruling from a U.S. court saying that they can't enforce it here. So far they've won. They won in the district court level. The district court found that it had jurisdiction over the case and then said that this would not be acceptable in the United States essentially saying the French law would not be constitutional in the United States, which is a pretty obvious call. It's on appeal to the Ninth Circuit right now. We filed an amicus brief along with a number of other civil liberties groups. The religion stuff, again, everyone's familiar with the way the Church of Scientology has been. The funny thing is when we talked about it before, it was they were being the private censors. But the church has also been the victim of censorship in other countries. You know, the Germans don't like the Scientologists at all. And so they've been trying to block Scientology sites. The Pope and I guess it's the Vatican as well as the Italians, they found a number of websites to be blasphemous and either shut them down or blocked them. This sort of stuff is just going to continue. Private sector, recently, one of the things you have to start to understand about defamation law is that defamation law is very, very protective of speech in the United States. For anybody who's a public figure in particular, there's this thing called the New York Times versus Sullivan rule, which says that you have to prove actual malice. I won't go into the details of what exactly that means, but suffice to say that it's a very, very hard standard to meet. If you are a public figure, it's unlikely you will be able to win a defamation suit. All the burdens are on you. You have to prove that it was false. You have to prove that the publication occurred with reckless disregard as to the truth. And you have to prove all these things by clear and convincing evidence, et cetera, et cetera. That is not the case in other countries, and especially, and most important of those other countries, are all the English common law countries, because anything we say in English, they can read and they can understand, and they have it pretty much backwards. All the rules on libel and defamation favor the victim, and they also have a loser pays rule with respect to litigation. So, if you see that you're going down the tubes in a libel case involving an English court, you'd better settle pretty fast, because if you don't settle and you go to trial and lose, you will be paying for all of the other guy's legal costs. There's a well-known internet crank guy named Dr. Lawrence Godfrey who sues people all the time in England for defamation in news groups and whatever. And he's never lost. I don't know how much he's won because he's just one guy and he doesn't have much of a reputation anyway. But this is a dangerous area. There is a case going on right now in the High Court of Australia called Dow Jones versus Gutnick. Gutnick is sort of a Ted Turner, major Australian media mogul, based in, he lives in Victoria. And Dow Jones on its news service published an article that wasn't very nice to Gutnick. Now, Gutnick is clearly a public figure, and under U.S. law, this article has no legal problems. But there is no real public figure doctrine. There is no public figure doctrine of any weight in any of the U.K. countries. And so Dow Jones has already lost in the lower court in Victoria, and is probably going to lose in the High Court in Australia. And so we're going to continue to have some really interesting problems with regard to libel and a jurisdiction. Because the other thing is Dow Jones got sued in Australia. Now, you don't have to be Dow Jones, right, to be liable for defamation. You could be making an innocent comment in a Usenet news group or on an AOL site or something that defames somebody in Australia, and you know, if it works against Dow Jones, it'll work against you. They can sue you in Victoria, and you know, you could very well lose big time. Okay, this is pretty much the thing what I already talked about, just formalized slightly. These are the issues involved in the who's reading what where problem. Amplification of harm, the size of the scope of the audience, and also combined with that, the fact that you don't really know different standards from one place to another. Well, the way the policymakers have seen it, they say that the fact that they don't know who you are and where you are is the problem. And so there are a lot of proposals out about that. We think that that is a really bad way to address the problem. EFF would rather live with a lot of these issues than have a world where no one has any sort of ability to speak anonymously on the internet. Techno-speech, I really did go into this before. The main thing that I would add here is one of the reasons we have this problem is because of the DMCA. The DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, not only makes it unlawful to perform acts of circumvention of technical protection measures like crypto applied to digital works, it also means you can't publish tools for doing so, including, and actually the language of the statute is technology. So, for instance, I represented, we represented somebody, a journalist, author, publisher of 2600 Magazine, who published the DCSS code for unlocking DVDs. I represented a researcher who published information about the weaknesses in watermark technology. Both of these led to DMCA threats. A couple more examples. At a DRM conference, there were a number of foreign researchers who did not come to the United States because they were concerned that the DMCA would render them liable. Even the Americans who were there were wondering whether or not, for instance, ACM would have any, Association for Computing Machinery is one of these big sort of academic computing groups, they were wondering whether or not ACM insurance, you know, would protect them in case, as a part of a panel that they organized, some researcher presented security weakness information that would lead to a lawsuit. In the Felton case, one of the things you have to remember is this guy and his team had this paper that explained how watermarks technology could be circumvented, but the threat to them also extended to the organizers of the conference at which they were presenting. That is, their paper was peer-reviewed for the Information Hiding Workshop, sort of a steganography group in Pittsburgh, And every one of those organizers was very, very afraid. And in fact, the organizer was an employee of the Navy, and the Navy, as far as we can tell, forced him to take down the site. And he ended up resigning completely from the conference organization because he couldn't deal with all of the pressure that was coming both from the corporations that were suing him and from his own employer. There's also chilling of stuff like the hacking of the Sony IBOPET, hacking of Lego Mindstorms. In both these cases, it never went to litigation, but there was a lot of legal stuff tossed around, again, because of the DMCA and other intellectual property issues. And this is why we think that this is a very, very bad law. One of the reasons. There are lots of others. I talked about most of this stuff. Do not forget that, you know, there are a lot of other areas of intellectual property law that also constrain speech. We've got a case in California right now involving someone who published information about, again, about DCSS, and there he's being sued under trade secret law. This is the sort of the big picture that I want you, that I hope that you guys can take away from this talk, even if you don't have the details, the concern I have about choke points. There has always been a lot of utopian talk about how the net can't be regulated. You know, the net, you know, my old boss used to say, you know, the net interprets censorship as damage and routes around it. Well, that's only the case if you control routing and control all of the points and choke points through which information flows. And you don't, I don't. Most of us rely on somebody else. We can see this very easily in the spam wars. You know, if you run something, a domain, an open relay, or something that Paul Vixie and the Maps people think is bad because you're helping spammers, you know, they put you on their blacklist, and all of a sudden, you know, you're not getting email. There's all sorts of bad stuff that can be done to you simply because a large number of people on the internet believe that you shouldn't be there. Well, you know, you can turn that around and say, well, you know, yeah, if the government wants to put pressure, if a big company says, well, you know, that website that you're hosting contains stuff we really, really don't like, and we're prepared to litigate against you if you don't take it down, you know, unless you're a very big ISP. You know, what if you're a mom and pop ISP, what are you going to do? You know, are you going to defend your single, this one particular person that you, the customer, or are you going to say, I don't want to spend, you know, $100,000 on legal bills? You know, this is one of those do the math issues. So, you know, I call this sort of the elephant mice problem or dilemma. As long as there are points that they can target and attack, somebody who wants to control the flow of information has an easy place to cut it off. Now, we have always sort of relied on the notion or thought that the internet is too decentralized for that to happen, and maybe it is, I don't think it's there yet. Even if it were there, there is a problem that the mouse side of the problem is that, there are a lot of mice, it's hard to get very many of them, but on the other hand, they may scare very easily. If, you know, let's say we're in a peer-to-peer decentralized environment and they just find one or two nodes and go after them very hard with the criminal charges, well, once some of those people start getting thrown into jail, how many other people who are using a peer-to-peer network will say, oh, you know, they can't get me? Pretty soon, you know, you need critical mass for a lot of these sorts of protections. But in a divide and conquer, pick on the weak sort of strategy, you can lose critical mass very easily. It's not just about that kind of physical layer. It's not just about, it's also about technologically based controls. You know, they build a lot of stuff into technical standards. They can digital rights management into an OS, into hardware. Microsoft has this new system called Palladium. Intel is leading an alliance called TCPA. All of these things are actually, you know, they start out as DRM, but you know, DRM can as much be an instrument for censoring speech from a political or content perspective as it can be for doing it from a copyright or other kind of perspective. I mean, it's just a tool. It's up to who's in control to decide how it's used. And the whole point of something like Palladium is that the user is not in control. When they talk about trusted hardware or trustable hardware, the person they see as the threat to trust is you. You know, it can be in browsers, your email, sensorware. Spam assassin is something that I consider very interesting because right now my ISP runs Spam Assassin. It obviously is looking at all the content of my email. It can tell me that, you know, all these words are in it. And I'm going, well, I'm no big spam fan, but I don't really like this. And, you know, if Spam Assassin can do that, then it can also find all sorts of other words. And, you know, people used to be concerned that the NSA was scanning all of our email and looking for bad words and things. I don't think they have to do that, right? Because right now the ISPs are doing it for them. It's not such a big task if every ISP is running content monitoring software for content to be monitored. Sort of last major point, anti-terrorism simply exacerbates everything. And it's especially bad for hackers because hackers are always talking about vulnerabilities, but talking about vulnerabilities is the sort of thing that right now in this atmosphere of hysteria caused by the Patriot Act, people really, really take that stuff seriously. And, you know, who knows what will happen the next time a hacker does the sort of, if you don't fix this problem, we will release it in 14 days sort of thing. It may not be viewed simply as an attempt to get a security hole fixed. It may be viewed as something more sinister. And we already have a lot of problems with internet cafes all over the world that are being shut down or forced to log. One thing that I think is a really, really big issue coming up is and I didn't put this down because I forgot, it's called mandatory data retention. This is already happening in the European Union. Right now, the ISP has no legal obligation to keep track of IP addresses and that sort of thing when you do your web surfing or anything else. Your bank, on the other hand, is required to keep all sorts of transactional records. I am sure the day is coming when the government is going to try to impose those same kinds of transactional records-keeping rules on ISPs so that every ISP has available to the government when it wants to a record of what you've seen, what you've read, the sites you've been going to on the internet. Right now, I advise my clients to sanitize that stuff, to not keep those records, because if a subpoena is issued to them, and they don't know what websites I've gone to or you have gone to, then they cannot rat you out. I expect that they will try and prevent that strategy from working. So in conclusion, all will get worse before it gets better. People, internet folks, are a little too optimistic, I think, about their technical abilities and the ability of technology to win over law and politics. I think politics and law are much more powerful, especially when you have many, many more people on the internet who can be easily scared and who think they know more about what's going on than they really do. And then, of course, you know, the businesses and the government are full of technical people who are actually helping the other side, well, from what I would call the other side. So this is not something to underestimate. We all need to be more active, and of course, you know, I would love you all to join EFF. Thank you very much. I'm really sorry I ran so far over, but if there are any questions, that would be fine.
Okay, I also have some envelopes if you're interested in donating to the EFF or joining. I have some envelopes here. If you're interested, just raise your hand, and I'll bring one out to you.
With regard to the Supreme Court decision on virtual child pornography, right now there's no ability, virtually no ability, for anyone to create a child in an image that you can't tell. is created. You can obviously tell the real children from the created children. Probably in about 10 years, the technology to do that is going to be very easy. So when presented with child pornography, the police are not going to know whether it's a crime or whether it's not a crime, and it could prevent them from prosecuting people who actually committed a crime against a child. Does that fact affect your feeling about the Supreme Court ruling?
Well, there are I have sort of two responses. The first is that in many cases, I think the kind of case you're describing is actually a fairly narrow segment, because many times it will be possible to charge under the regular obscenity statute. Again, I think you have to keep in mind that child pornography was designed as sort of a special, easy way to go after certain kinds of depictions because they were harming real children. But in fact, much child pornography could also be charged as obscenity. So I think that the number of cases where that's going to be a problem is small. Second, that's actually the argument that's one of the arguments that the government made in the Supreme Court case, that in these situations of virtual indistinguishability, it would be very difficult to actually charge for child pornography. And the Supreme Court said, well, we have seen no evidence yet that this is a problem. When you have evidence that this is a problem, you know, we will rethink it. And I think that's the right way to look at it. Until that happens, the court's not going to do anything about it.
I would just like to speak to that and say that I think in situations like that, the burden of proof is going to just switch, and having that particular video or having that particular image is no longer going to be considered proof that a crime was committed. They're going to have someone saying, that's me in that image, and I was actually doing that, and this is, you know, where that happened or, you know, how that happened to me. I think it's going to be more of a matter of being able to prove that it's a real person versus a virtual person.
Two questions. The case involving Church of Scientology and Google, was that an out-of-court settlement or was that a court order?
That did not get litigated. It was they served them. I think it was a cease and desist letter, and Google pretty much immediately caved. Probably took maybe a week, where they said, "Well, we can't handle this." And you know, they were thinking ahead because it could happen to them they could get that kind of lawsuit from a lot of different directions. And you know, Google is successful in its business model, but they don't have that much, and they weren't sure that they were protected by the kind of things that the CDA Section 230 protects ISPs against. So yeah, they caved. Now, they did do one thing. We have a website called Chilling Effects. It's a joint project that EFF has with the Berkman Center for Law and Society at Harvard. And what we do at the Chilling Effects website is we print cease and desist nasty grams and make it very clear so that people can see who is trying to chill speech. And in this case, Google did a funny thing, which was if you try to get to the site that they blocked because of Church of Scientology, you get some sort of a message that says, see the Chilling Effects thing. And at the Chilling Effects website are links to the sites. And so it was actually pretty clever. They're not carrying it, but they still provide you with the information on how to get there.
And you also mentioned what you referred to as the Nuremberg Files, the en banc decision. I presume that's being appealed?
I don't know if it has been. I know they are thinking very much about it. I certainly think they should, because, I mean, I think as long as they have the money, a 6-5 decision from the Ninth Circuit is not worth a whole lot in the Supreme Court, right? I mean, the Ninth Circuit, in, you know, based out of California, is huge and is the most reversed circuit of all. I mean, it's a strange circuit. I like it, but it's unpredictable. The Supreme Court doesn't like it. They're all, I mean, sometimes they get reversed 9-0 by the Supreme Court, I mean, a couple of times a year, which is pretty incredible because it means they couldn't get a single Supreme Court justice to agree with the way that they looked at the case. So a 6-5 case coming out on the Ninth Circuit, you know, I'd appeal it as long as I could afford to. I assume that they will because the Nuremberg Files website owner is a, you know, what I call an ideological plaintiff. This is there are plenty of people who want to see that site survive. So, yeah, it'll probably go up.
You mentioned something about Lego MindLink or something. What is it?
About what?
Lego something. Lego.
Lego Mindstorms.
Okay.
You know, Lego Mindstorms is this computer robotic Lego thing. Sort of think based loosely on the Seymour Papert's sort of logo stuff.
And they were using DMCA to restrict sharing any information about that. And that's
well,
really
they were threatening, right? Because what people were doing was people were hacking the Mindstorms stuff, and Lego wasn't sure whether it approved of that. And so they made some public statements saying, you know, well, there's a DMCA problem, blah, 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 blah. Eventually, they actually agreed, they actually decided that that it was okay.
Yeah, and there's no copying involved here, and yet this DMCA is called a copyright law, but it seems that it controls technology as much as anything
well,
else.
Well, yeah, I mean, the DMCA deals with both unauthorized, both with copying and with copy controls and access controls. And you have to realize that access controls is a very, very broad notion, and many companies have argued that weird stuff, something as simple as format incompatibility, constitutes a technical protection measure under the DMCA. So, you know, if you design, set up a port or a card slot that has a different form factor, people will argue that's a DMCA technical protection measure against access. So so it's very broad, and almost anyone can throw that sort of idea out. Oh.
I guess Legoland isn't such a happy place anymore, huh?
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
I said I guess Legoland isn't such a happy place anymore now.
Well, yeah, I mean, Legos.
That wasn't my question. That was just a smart aleck comment.
Okay.
My question was about the Chilling Effect website. I'm assuming you've gotten cease and desist orders on this site. Have you had that? And if you do get that, if people try to shut this site down or portions of it, what is going to be your response to that? The nasty gram cease and desist orders that you're publishing on the Chilling Effect site.
Oh, no one has issued a nasty gram against us.
What's going to be your response if they do? It seems to be inevitable if you're doing that.
If they do that, you know, we'll fight.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, our Chilling Effects website is a joint project of, as I said, Berkman and EFF. That's Harvard Law School and the EFF. You know, we have the resources and the legal expertise to defend ourselves. I think anybody would be insane to try to stop that website from coming up. And if they do, as my attitude is, come on, we'll take you on.
I had a question about, I believe it's Senator Berman's bill that he's trying to get through.
The P2P digital vigilantism bill?
To me, it seems a little bit hypocritical in that basically it allows a select group of people to in turn hack for copyright protection. And I was just wondering, I came in a little late, so you might have already addressed this, but I was wondering what your opinion on it was.
Well, actually, you're about a day... sort of a day late, because this talk was about freedom of speech. Yesterday's talk was about intellectual property, and I actually talked very briefly about that yesterday. We think the Berman bill, it's a piece of shit. I mean, it sucks. It's stupid. It authorizes any copyright owner to go after P2P systems and cause small amounts of damage in the name of, and possibly more damage, in the name of protecting copyright. And it makes it very hard for anyone who is harmed to get any kind of compensation in case there was anything wrongfully done, because you have to get the permission of the Attorney General to sue. Yes, this is vigilantism. This is bad for computer security. I mean, we are working with a group of sysadmins and sysops right now to put together a white paper explaining just how bad for their jobs this would be. And considering that right now, there is a lot of heightened concern about computer security, it seems to me, seems to us, the last thing you want to do is to authorize, you know, some people to be able to probe and attack and to do stuff, and not everyone else, because you're not going to be able to, adequately protect people's systems. And, you know, they also, I think, have forgotten that, you know, the RIAA and the MPAA are not the only copyright owners out there. You know, pretty much all of us are copyright owners if we've created any piece, any original work of authorship.
It's interesting. It's almost, if you've ever created a work, it's almost a free license to hack.
Yeah, it is. That's right. And also, they're not just Americans, too, right? I mean, you know, there are copyright owners all over the world. And, you know, the idea that all of them are going to be, you know, get some sort of a free ride to hack the P2P systems is ludicrous. But, you know, that's the way it is in Congress right now on piracy. It's just, they're just insane.
What kind of political support, if any, is that bill getting in California? That's where it originates from.
Yeah, Berman. Well, you know, Berman's from Southern California. He gets money from the.
I knew all this. I'm just wondering what realistic chance does it have even getting through a committee and actually into a vote? Do you have any idea?
I think it has a realistic chance.
Right.
I think it has a realistic chance for.
Has it been
two reasons. One, and I always say this, anything has a realistic chance if it's against piracy. If you were at my talk yesterday, I showed how many new laws protecting copyright owners and attacking supposedly piracy had been passed in the last 10 years. I pointed out that since 1962, the term of copyright has been extended 11 times. Copyright is very, very powerful in Congress. Hollywood, MPAA, RIAA, they are very powerful. And it is, and very, very few people understand our side of the story. Very few people understand why these things are bad. And so it's very easy to get someone to say, oh, sure, you know, if you're limited to a 1 minute, 30-second soundbite to try to get the vote of a congressman on this. You know, if Jack Valenti has a minute and I have a minute, Jack Valenti is going to win every time, because it's going to take a lot, because it's a lot easier for him to get his message across. Piracy is theft. Piracy is bad. If you don't stop piracy, there won't be any more movies. You know, that's he doesn't have to say a whole lot more. And he also says, and you won't get any money from us. What do I say? What does any of you say to him? It takes you a long time to explain all the problems. That's why any kind of bill like this is very, very dangerous. We're out of time. Thank you.